Our teacher for this morning's Sunday school class is Brother Al Bryan, and he has entitled his remarks this morning, "Post-Brexit and the Rise of the European Beast." And for the reading, he has selected Revelation chapter 16, verses 13 through 16. "And I saw the unclean spirits like frogs come out of the mouth of the dragon, and out of the mouth of the beast, and out of the mouth of the false prophet. And they are the spirits of devils, working miracles, which go forth unto the kings of the earth, to the whole world, to gather them to the battle of the great day of God Almighty. Behold, I come as a thief. Blessed is he that watcheth and keepeth his garments, lest he walk naked, and they see his shame. And he gathered them together into the place in the Hebrew tongue, Armageddon." Brother Al.
Good morning, everyone. We're all from the Bonaire Christadelphian Ecclesia very happy to be with you all this morning and appreciate the work of all the brethren here to put on this event every year. It's a great relief after all the winter months. Make sure the antenna is out here. Go. In these verses of the Apocalypse that were just read, we find the existence of a particular spirit in man called unclean spirits like frogs that emanate from the mouth of the beast, which we would describe as continental Europe, the mouth of the dragon, which originally was the seat of the Eastern Roman Dominion in Constantinople, which we believe is now removed to Moscow, the Third Rome. And thirdly, the false prophet or the Roman Catholic papacy. These three entities, speaking the same dogma, whatever it be, move the nations under their influence, namely those constituting the ten-toed dominion of the European theater, along with their Shiite Muslim allies, if not willingly, then certainly by constraint, into joining their evil thought to rid the earth once and for all of the Jewish question, while at the same time exercising all diligence to expedite their goal of world dominion. Let's turn over to Jeremiah 51, verse 7. Jeremiah 51, verse 7. "Babylon hath been a golden cup in the Lord's hand that made all the earth drunken. The nations have drunken of her wine, therefore the nations are mad." Very applicable today. What madness will infect the minds of these nations to attempt this end-time genocide of the Jewish people? Vanquishing the one political entity on the planet that is directly connected with the existence of Yahweh Elohim, the Mighty One of Israel. Whatever it be, in the time remaining, we would like to examine the root cause that is fueling the rise of the European beast and leading the nations headlong to Armageddon, ushering in the apocalypse of the Lord Jesus Christ. To begin, we need to backtrack with a little history that precedes the verses that were read. The first 11 verses of the 16th chapter of Revelation, we'll read a few of them later, vials 1 through 5, deal primarily with events that were happening in continental Europe and environs between 1790 and 1815, following on the heels of the French Revolution, which, as you know, the revolution in which the so-called Third Estate, or the peasantry, rose up against the monarchy and the clergy. And here they are beating to pieces the elements of those upper two classes. They had accomplished their goal of throwing off the shackles of monarchical and church tyranny and had now transitioned to a defensive position. All of Europe that remained, as well as England, and their monarchical institutions and traditions of church and state were now at risk if this fevered pitch by the peasantry that had overthrown the French monarchy should escape the borders of France and infect their own lands. What then? Thus, the new fledgling French Republic, having so clearly proclaimed and established as its national soul the so-called rights of the common man, liberty, equality, fraternity, now came under military siege by the combined forces of Britain, Austria, and Russia. To counter this threat of their newfound French Republic, they armed themselves to the teeth and went on the offensive. Witnessing the brilliant and meteoric career of Napoleon Bonaparte, who, in little more than a decade, beginning in 1793, rose in rank from an artillery captain at the Battle of Toulon to crowning himself Emperor of France in 1804 in the presence of the Pope, and seemingly in control of the political heavens of continental Europe. Of course, we know who's really in control. Thus, that system of democracy, or rule by the people, which had at the first decried the rights and equality of all men, throwing out all things monarchical and tyrannical, produced one of the greatest and absolute military despots that the world has ever known, perhaps on par with Alexander the Great, Julius Caesar, or Constantine. Perhaps Queen Louise of Prussia described it well when she said, quote, "Napoleon is a monster who has emerged from the mire," unquote, a blatant insult with regard to the frog empire of the French. Nevertheless, using his formula of high spirit nationalism and brilliant military strategy — it was only brilliant because the Elohim made it so, by the way — Napoleon inspired his troops to sally forth to whatever heights he thought that Republic and later the Empire should achieve, inflicting massive wounds into the heart of every corner of papal Europe. Of course, all this being orchestrated by the Elohim and the Lord Jesus Christ as punishment, specifically those five vials of wrath, for the evil deeds of the Roman Catholic Church under their influence. Thus, Napoleon, as the son of Austerlitz, he was so called, prefigured the Son of Righteousness in this respect, that is, the complete overthrow of the Roman Catholic dominion. Turn with me to Revelation 16, and we'll go back to verse 1. Revelation 16, 1. "And I heard a great voice out of the temple saying to the seven angels, 'Go your ways and pour out the vials of wrath of God upon the earth.'" And so there were five of them, all but the second vial related to continental Europe. And then drop down to verse 10. "And the fifth angel poured out his vial upon the seat of the beast. And his kingdom was full of darkness, and they gnawed their tongues for pain and blasphemed the God of heaven because of their pains and their sores. And, of course, repented not of their deeds." Thus ended Napoleon's career by the Spirit. As we know, he was at length defeated at Waterloo, and the French Empire settled back under a pre-Napoleonic monarchy, placing the frog spirit in check for a time. However, that spirit of democracy broke out again in 1830, creating a constitutional French monarchy, and then again in 1848, called by Brother Thomas the Year of revolution. Of course, 1848 being the year of Eltis Israel's writing. And then there was a second French Republic being born, only to be overthrown by Napoleon III in 1852, and reborn again as the Third French Republic in 1870. In the meantime, the revolutions of 1848, known in some countries as the Spring of Nations, that term has been used again in recent history, the People's Spring, Springtime of the Peoples, or as Brother Thomas called it, the Year of Revolution, were a series of political upheavals throughout Europe, and it remains the most widespread revolutionary wave in European history. The revolutions which spread across Europe, beginning in France in February of 1848, were of a democratic nature with the aim of removing the old monarchical structures and creating independent nation-states. So think ten-toe, ten-horned kingdoms. Initially, over 50 countries were affected due to widespread dissatisfaction with political leadership, demands for more participation in government, and, of course, democracy. From 1848 and onward, the spirits like frogs could no longer be contained, and like the plague upon the Egyptians, the river of nations brought forth frogs abundantly, which shall go up and come into thine house, and into thy bedchamber, and upon thy bed, and into thy house of thy servants, and upon thy people, and into thine ovens, and into thy kneading troughs. Exodus 8:3. In other words, every facet of society would be affected by these unclean spirits. Unclean because they are of man's making, based upon the law of reason, man's reason. Unlike the Egyptian plague, however, which was stayed for a brief period, these frog-like spirits would remain in effect and grow further afield in numbers and amplitude until the Lord's return to the earth, when he gathers together the nations in heaps, and their stink astride the rivers of nations will come up. Of course, we can witness them at work around us today, primarily through the work of the Fourth Estate, which we see at work even this morning. In the humanist ideologues that have saturated industry, entertainment, sports, politics, and so forth, driving mankind to ungodliness in every aspect of life. With this in mind, it's needful to keep reminding ourselves of the divine perspective in the case, that the revolutionary spirit of France proclaiming equal rights to all, that is, liberty, equality, fraternity, appears to be at the heart of the matter in these affairs and is purely of human invention. However, this principle at work around us, having invaded the land, as it were, did not begin with the French Revolution of 1789, but we can go back much earlier. So we're going to jump back in history a little bit and look at Clovis, the king of the Franks in the 5th century A.D., founding what we would consider to be the first Catholicized toe kingdom of Europe that would ultimately comprise the clay-footed image that Nebuchadnezzar dreamt. Clovis, when it's actually pronounced Louis, but we're going to stick with Clovis, whose royal heraldry was embroidered upon banners and shields, including the fleur-de-lis, with three frogs astride, so think, again, the three unclean spirits like frogs, Revelation 16:13, introduced the principle of democracy to his own troops and, like Napoleon, inspired them to victory. The historian Edward Gibbon records, quote, when he first took to the field, he had neither gold nor silver in his coffers, nor wine and corn in his magazines, but he imitated the example of Caesar, who in the same country had acquired wealth by the sword and purchased soldiers with the fruits of conquest, unquote. Each warrior thus submitted himself to the equal regulations of military law, on the one hand, and after each successful battle, everyone received an equal proportion of the spoils. Thus, a democratic organization beneath his command attracted the loyalty of his troops. While himself a pagan, Clovis was married to a Catholic princess, the niece of the King of Burgundy. And by the way, he is sort of the patriarch, or was the patriarch, of the French monarchy, whose religion he largely disregarded. Again, he was pagan. Until at the Battle of Tolbiac in AD 506, finding himself on the cusp of defeat, Clovis called upon the God of his Catholic wife and the Christians. And thereafter, his fortunes in battle changed with eventual victory. Attributing his military success in conquering Gaul to the Christian God, not unlike Constantine at the Battle of the Milvian Bridge some centuries earlier, Clovis and 3,000 of his troops were baptized into the Catholic faith by the Bishop of Reims and was thereafter awarded the title, 1, eldest son of the church, and 2, consul and Augustus by the Roman Emperor in Constantinople. The conversion of Clovis to Catholicism, by which he purchased the Roman title of Augustus, coupled with the introduction of democracy to his followers and the identification of his sovereignty with the sign of 3 frogs, is highly significant. These are clues that help us identify the fabric of continental Europe and the underlying principles that will bind each successive toe kingdom together in the eventual image empire as they move closer to the end time. So keep in mind these 3 clues. 1, politically Roman. 2, religiously Catholic. And 3, principally democratic. And when we say democratic, democratic to begin. But democratic never stays democratic, as we'll see. Let's turn back to Daniel chapter 11, verse 38 and 39. Daniel 11:38. But in his estate shall he honor the God of forces, and a God whom his fathers knew not shall he honor with gold and silver and with precious stones and pleasant things. Thus shall he do in the most strongholds with a strange God, whom he shall acknowledge and increase with glory, and he shall cause them to rule over many and shall divide the land for gain. So very much similar to the Emperor Constantine, who saw Christianity as a means to an end. Clovis, likewise, honored a God whom his fathers knew not. A Catholic God that intoxicates those under its influence, serving up just enough superstition to keep the masses in doubt as concerning their eternal welfare, and just enough democracy to appease the thinking of the flesh. With this snapshot of history regarding how the frog-like spirit of democracy works, we can also look forward in time concerning sacred prophecy and see how the Almighty has allowed this principle of man's invention to ferment in order to prepare the nations for Armageddon. Brother Thomas observed that as Clovis, king of the first toe kingdom of the Image Empire, submitted to the papal yoke, so too may we anticipate the movement of the nation states in this direction at the time of the end. Let's pause for a moment before we continue our timeline on democracy with a few interesting quotations from the founders of this country that demonstrate, I think, at least what we have learned so far, and interestingly show their particular contempt for democracy as a means of governance. James Madison, in Federalist Paper No. 10, wrote that in a pure democracy, There is nothing to check the inducement to sacrifice the weaker party or the obnoxious individual. So you can think of that in context with the French Revolution and what happened there with the Reign of Terror, or in a larger context, the evil thought of Gog, who will not think twice about the obnoxious individual being Israel. At the 1787 Constitutional Convention, Edmund Randolph, the first Attorney General serving under George Washington, said, "In tracing these evils of government to their origin, every man had found it in the turbulence and follies of democracy." Alexander Hamilton agreed, saying, "We are now forming a republican government. Liberty is found not in the extremes of democracy, but in moderate governments. If we incline too much democracy, we shall soon shoot into a monarchy." John Adams, the second president of the United States, reminded his contemporaries, "Remember, democracy never lasts long. It soon wastes, exhausts, and murders itself. There was never a democracy yet that did not commit suicide." Finally, Thomas Paine, the author of the revolutionary inspiring document Common Sense, said, "A democracy is the vilest form of government there is." All of these men from whom we have quoted were, of course, revolutionaries against the King of England. They were also humanists and philosophers, so we would not be on the same page with them on many points. Yet, they could see the dangers inherent in an unchecked spirit of democracy, which, from their perspective across the pages of history, would ultimately produce tyranny. Little did they know that the French, who were then allied with them in the colonial struggle against England, would prove them to be absolutely correct. The frog spirit of democracy ultimately leads to tyranny. For time's sake, we will just have to touch upon Charlemagne, crowned by Pope Leo III on the 25th of December, 800 AD. So we're fast forward 3 centuries from Clovis. Founding the Holy Roman Empire. From Hamlin's History of the World, we quote, "The Pope rewarded him by placing a golden crown on his head and saluting him as Carolus Augustus, Emperor of the Romans. The crowd responded with a shout, 'God bless and save Carolus Augustus, crowned of God, the great and peace-bringing Emperor of the Romans.'" So you see another pattern here, very similar to Clovis, who preceded him. And that reward was for rescuing the papacy from the Lombards that you see there in the lower right-hand side of the screen. So that red outline is the extent of his empire. As we mentioned before, the last vestiges of this Catholic empire, begun by Charlemagne, or maybe even back to Clovis, were destroyed by Napoleon in 1806, 1,000 years hence. But remember what we said about the 3 clues that would associate the 10-toe kingdoms of the image empire at the time of the end? 1, politically Roman. 2, religiously Catholic. 3, principally democratic. These 3 together are being prepared today once again, right before us, for the purpose of making war with the Lamb. So let's turn over to Revelation 17, verse 8. Revelation 17, 8. "The beast that thou sawest was and is not, and shall ascend out of the bottomless pit, and go into perdition. And they that dwell on the earth shall wonder, whose names were not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they behold the beast that was and is not and yet is." And verses 13 and 14. "These have one mind." They have a concord together. "And they shall give their power and strength unto the beast, These shall make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb shall overcome them, for He is Lord of lords and King of kings, and they that are with Him. And we hope, brothers and sisters, that will be all of us here, as well as many others, are called and chosen and faithful. Fast forward in time to 1950. The Second World War has come to a close. Europe is beginning to rebuild following two failed attempts by Germany to resurrect Charlemagne's empire. That would be the Second and Third Reichs. That was an attempt to resurrect Charlemagne's empire, styled by the spirit, the beast of the earth. Yet efforts to resurrect the Roman beast have continued as determined as ever. The unification of Europe today, presently championed by Germany's Christian Democratic Union leader, Angela Merkel, is nothing less than a means of bringing the beast out of the bottomless pit, whereby it will oppose Jesus and the immortalized saints. After World War II, France and Europe cried that never again will Germany be allowed to have access to the Ruhr and Saar basins in the Rhineland. Those basins are where lay huge coal and iron deposits that fueled Nazi Germany's war machine. But the people of Europe have forgotten history, and so run headlong into a repeat of her past in the form of so-called European Union. This phase of the beast's development began with a desire to unite Europe by controlling these coal and steel regions, which were fundamental to war industries. The project was dubbed the European Coal and Steel Community, or ECSC, which linked the German economy with France. Quoting Robert Schuman in 1950, he used the French Minister of Foreign Affairs, declared, "Through the consolidation of basic production and the institution of a new high authority, whose decisions will bind France, Germany, and other countries that join, this proposal represents the first concrete steps towards a European federation imperative for the preservation of peace." Now keep in mind what he's saying, imperative for the preservation of peace, because we'll find out from many of their critics that is not true. In 1957, another European treaty was signed, styled the Treaty of Rome, of which we're all familiar, moving the latter-day beast system yet another step closer to unification. This treaty was signed at the Lateran Palace in the Vatican. The founding six countries represented six democratically elected signatories, all of whom were Roman Catholic. Immediately after signing the treaty, they all celebrated Mass together with the Pope. So the emerging woman riding the beast, identified with the number of man, six, has been well involved in this unification process from the beginning. In 1973, the UK joined the European Economic Community, or EEC, as it was then called, looking for a market to further build its economic engines. Many treaties later, we come to the Maastricht Treaty, February 7, 1992, bringing more European integration and formalizing the European Union known to us today as the EU. The treaty was signed in a very symbolic place for the Holy Roman Empire, that is, Aachen, the original throne of the beast of the earth, under Charlemagne. So remember that orb that Charlemagne held in his hand? That's what the papacy seeks today, the whole of Europe in its hand. Since 1992, there have been several other treaties in Europe, including the Treaty of Nice and the signing of the European Constitution in 2004, thus formalizing the governmental structure of the European Union at the political and religious center of ancient Rome. And here's a photo of that momentous event. It was at the occasion of the signing of this treaty, October 29, 2004, that Tony Blair, Prime Minister of the UK, signed away Britain's sovereignty and bound them to a system of unelected bureaucrats known as the European Commission, who make all the laws but are answerable to nobody. Nigel Farage, former EU member of Parliament, had it right when he explained that, quote, our parents signed up for a common market, for the advancement of trade and mutual economic benefits, but the EU has morphed into an unelected council of bureaucrats, deciding how everyone else is supposed to live, act, and govern, and now, he said, you even want your own army. Unquote. Mr. Farage, in his farewell speech, scolded the EU Commission, pointing out that their form of government was unacceptable and did not represent the principles of democracy. On that last point, I would have to disagree with Mr. Farage. Remember what Alexander Hamilton wrote? Quote, if we incline too much democracy, we shall soon shoot into a monarchy. But even that statement falls short, as history demonstrates that democracy or rule by the people ultimately leads to imperial, not monarchical, rule. In other words, democracy does not make kingdoms, it makes empires. And the empire of which we are prophetically familiar is represented in the dream of Nebuchadnezzar, a sovereign Assyrian head whom the Spirit by Ezekiel identifies as Gog of the land of Magog, the prince of Rosh, Meshech, and Tubal, ruling over a ten-toe, ten-horn empire. Yet, looking backwards, there appears to have been a divine purpose in this very painful arrangement for the UK to be bound to Europe. First, UK, as you know, has always been the odd man out in the EU, as they refuse to tie themselves to a European currency, and they have always been remiss about the many unwelcome restraints imposed upon them from Brussels. In any case, the policies of the UK are not those of Europe. The UK has essentially held back the imperial inclinations of the beast with a yoke of sanity that is not based in Catholic sentiment. But the time of holding back, we suggest to you, is over. Let's turn over to Isaiah 23. And we're going to just read a part of this. Let's pick up at verse 14. Isaiah 23:14. Howl, ye ships of Tarshish, for your strength is laid waste. And it shall come to pass in that day that Tyre shall be forgotten 70 years according to the days of one king. After the end of 70 years shall Tyre sing as an harlot. Take an harp, go about the city, thou harlot that hast been forgotten. Make sweet melody, sing many songs, that thou mayest be remembered. And it shall come to pass, after the end of 70 years, that Yahweh will visit Tyre, and she shall turn to her hire, and shall commit fornication with all the kingdoms of the world upon the face of the earth. And her merchandise and her hire shall be holiness to Yahweh. It shall not be treasured nor laid up, for her merchandise shall be for them that dwell before Yahweh, to eat sufficiently and for durable clothing. This passage, in my view, is what I call the Brexit prophecy. While we haven't time for an exposition of all these verses, suffice it to say that there is a historical application to literal Tyre during the time of the Babylonian captivity of Israel, as well as a latter-day application to the daughter of Tyre, or Great Britain. And we suggest to you that Britain is now emerging from the 70 years of regression, during which it lost its empire in toto. So you go online sometime and find a map that tracks the British Empire. You will find the last 70 years, they lost it completely. Based upon the EU referendum, which passed in June of 2016, the UK Parliament gave notice to the European Union by triggering Article 50 on March 29, 2017, formally beginning the Brexit process. Here we are today, and remarkably, it is an accomplished fact. There is no turning back. The results which we have anticipated as Christadelphians looking at the political heavens for some time, are exactly as predicted by the prophets and executed precisely by the Elohim. And this will forever change the course of history from man's perspective. The latter-day Tyre among nations will once again court her financial lovers abroad, and strictly in accordance with the divine blueprint, will become fabulously wealthy. But it will not be wealth that she's able to store up for herself. It will be consecrated to Yahweh. Those of the Commonwealth, long ignored when London had turned to Brussels, will once again be welcome, and the results will drive the nations to their respective roles at the time of the end. So now that Great Britain is off to meet her destiny, where is Europe headed post-Brexit? We would like to wrap up this analysis with a view to where Europe, by its own word, is heading, divinely orchestrated, that is, the rise of the European beast in its final form. In an EU report titled, quote, "Should Europe aim to become a superstate," unquote, we share with you the following. It is widely argued and in many quarters taken for granted that in the 21st century, Europe needs to become a giant superstate, able to take its seat at the table of global geopolitical power alongside the United States and China. Former UK Prime Minister Tony Blair put it this way at the Council on Foreign Relations in New York last week. So that was just the first week of February 2020. He says, "The European project is not about peace. It's about power. It's about power." What do we read in Revelation? "These have one mind and shall give their power and strength unto the beast." Remember way back in the 1950s, they were saying this is about peace, but it's not about peace. The article continues. Over its near seven-decade evolution, treaty change by treaty change, the EU has concentrated more and more bureaucratic and political power in Brussels, and increasingly has taken on the mantle of a prescriptive administrative state and one with a palpable democratic deficit. A palpable democratic deficit. Remember, democracy leads to tyranny. Because of that, enough UK citizens see it that way is one reason Brexit happened. The EU must recognize that Brexit stands to be a game changer for it, and if mishandled, not a good one. The EU may have gone from 28 to 27 member states, but in terms of economic weight, note what he says here, it is as if it had gone to 10. In order of magnitude of gross domestic product, that would be Germany, France, Italy, Spain, Netherlands, Sweden, Poland, Belgium, Austria, Denmark, perhaps precisely the 10-toe kingdoms of Europe that we anticipate. At the 2020 Munich Security Conference, or MSC, French President Emmanuel Macron said on stage, "We cannot always go through the United States. No, we have to think in a European way as well," as he continued a theme of his presidency, projecting bold European sovereignty onto the international stage. The German defense minister said she completely agreed with Macron. "We have joint instruments and joint interests. Think Magog and Gomer. Magog and Gomer. We have joint instruments and joint interests. Let's finally create a joint political will," Kramp Karrenbauer told MSC's main chamber. "I want the effect of a German-European security and defense policy to be greater, our actions to be better coordinated internationally, and more clearly visible." Writing for Breitbart Europe, Victoria Friedman reports the following revealing trend among members of the EU Parliament now that the UK is out. Senior member of the European Parliament, G. Verhofstadt, leader of the Left Progressive Group, has made the extraordinary assessment that the lessons to be learnt from Brexit is for Brussels to push for more Europe and to take away more democracy from nation states. Keep in mind that members of parliament, of which he is one, were elected. But he wants to take away more democracy. Speaking ahead of the European Parliament's vote on the UK-EU withdrawal deal on Wednesday, Mr. Verhofstadt rejected the notion that the lesson to be learned from Brexit is to devolve power back to the nation state, but rather to give more power to Brussels. The former Belgian Prime Minister said, "This lesson, dear colleagues, is not to undo the Union, as some are arguing. The lesson is to deeply reform the Union, to make a real Union in the coming years. That means a Union without opt-ins, opt-outs, rebates, exceptions, and above all, without unanimity rules and veto rights." In other words, we decide the rules and you have no say. The MEP and European Parliament's Brexit coordinator has long been in favor of reducing democratic input of individual countries in order to grant more power to Brussels and, in effect, create a European superstate. He concluded, "Only then can we act. Only then can we defend our interests and defend our values. It is the lack of effectiveness that is the problem, and we have seen with Brexit." The reaction from a number of UK members of Parliament was predictable. I'll give you one example. Belinda De Lucy, who is the Member of Parliament for South East England, remarked, quote, "Democracy will not survive the EU. It can't." It would appear that Mr. Verhofstadt is in complete agreement, as he said that in order to compete with the rest of the world, the European Union must become an empire. The world is developing into one not of nation states, but of empires. China is an empire. India is an empire. The U.S. is an empire. We, the EU, need to create a European Union that is capable of defending our interests. Other prominent Eurocrats support these sentiments and have also voiced support for a United States of Europe. Greater centralization of power in Brussels and federalization, including former President of the European Parliament and German socialist politician Martin Schulz, who called for the formation of a United States of Europe by 2025. Jean-Claude Juncker, current President of the European Commission, in his State of the Union address, also called for a fully operational EU army by 2025. Responding to the Commission President's speech, former UKIP leader and Member of Parliament Nigel Farage blasted, "Mr. Juncker, that was the most open, honest, and truly worrying speech I've heard in my long years in this place. The message is very clear. Brexit has happened. Full steam ahead." And he's not talking about full steam ahead for Brexit, which certainly that will be the case. He's talking about Europe, full steam ahead for its imperialist ambitions. "There is to be one powerful president for the whole of the European Union." So he's repeating back what he just heard. "A finance minister with fresh powers to, as you say yourself, intervene as and when he sees necessary. A stronger European army in a militarized European Union with a stronger and perhaps more aggressive foreign policy, too." Let's turn over to Ezekiel 38. Verse 3. "And say, thus saith Adonai Yahweh, behold, I am against thee, O Gog, the chief prince of Meshech and Tubal. I will turn thee back and put hooks into thy jaws and will bring thee forth and all thine army, horses and horsemen, all of them clothed with all sorts of armor, even a great company with bucklers and shields, all of them handling swords. Persia, Ethiopia, and Libya with them, all of them with shield and helmet. Gomer, France and all his bands, the house of Targarma of the north quarters and all his bands, and many people with thee. Be thou prepared, and prepare for thyself, thou and all thy company that are assembled unto thee, and be thou a guard unto them. Verse 9, thou shalt ascend and come like a storm, thou shalt be like a cloud to cover the holy land, thou and all thy bands, and many people with thee. I believe it is quite evident that what we are witnessing in Europe today is the body politic of the Magogian and Gomerian henchmen of the Prince of Rosh in the making. And they and all of the Tento kingdoms of the Image Empire will be armed to the teeth. When fully developed and allied with Gog, these will comprise a reconstituted beast of the sea with an alliance between the mouth of the Russian dragon, once again planted in Constantinople, the mouth of the beast in Brussels, and the false prophet in Rome. When the two kingdoms are sundered from the body of the image empire that Nebuchadnezzar dreamt at Armageddon, then they will arise fully as the reconstituted beast of the earth, upon which the papal whore rides, and so receiving the adoration and worship she has coveted for a millennium. This last development we shall only see, having been accepted as immortal associates of Jesus Christ, when, Lord willing, we are with Him at the crisis to execute vengeance upon the heathen and punishments upon the people, to bind their kings with chains and their nobles with fetters of iron, to execute upon them the judgment written, this honor have all his saints. Brethren, reporting these events is not merely for the entertainment value. These are the Elohim forging the mold into which the nations must conform by the will of the Almighty. They have no choice in the matter. Albeit even bystanders in the secular and political heavens clearly see where this is going. A federated Europe with autocratic power. How much more should we, having the divine blueprints in our hands and with the eye of faith, not only know where this is going and why, but most importantly, what manner of persons ought we to be on this account? So I'd like to close by reading from 2 Peter chapter 3. Second Peter 3, and we'll pick up at verse 9. The Lord is not slack concerning His promise, as some men count slackness, but is long-suffering to usward. Look at all that He has allowed us to see, brothers and sisters. Not willing that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance. But the day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, in which the heavens shall pass away with a great noise, and the elements shall melt with fervent heat. The earth also and the works that are therein shall be burned up. Of course, this referring to AD 70, but what goes then goes now. Seeing then that all these things shall be dissolved, what manner of persons ought ye to be in all holy conversation and godliness, looking for and hasting unto the coming of the day of God, wherein the heavens being on fire shall be dissolved, and the elements shall melt with fervent heat. Nevertheless, we, according to His promise, look for a new heavens and new earth, wherein dwelleth righteousness. Wherefore, beloved, seeing that ye look for such things, be diligent, that ye may be found of Him in peace, without spot, and blameless. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Brother Al, from bringing us back historically to the current events as we see them unfolding around us. It is truly an exciting time in which we live. Is anyone notified Sister Sandra yet outdoors to bring the other students in? You do that. We will close our Sunday school this morning by singing together hymn number 140. And after which we'll